Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Rob Dunn. He is the William Neal Reynolds Distinguished Professor in the Department of Applied Ecology at North Carolina State University and in the Center for Evolutionary Hologenomics at the University of Copenhagen. And we're talking about his book, A Natural History of the Future, what the laws of biology tell us about the destiny of the human species. Rob, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Oh, it's great to be on the show. Thanks so much for having me.
I should say it's sobering to talk to you about this book. You talk about what some would call the rules of biological nature. You also use the word regularities. You call them laws. A lot of people would be surprised to know that there are laws in biology.
Well, one of the questions is what we should call them, but I'll step back there for a moment and say that in biology, there are these organizing principles of how life works that are reliable enough that we can use them to predict what's going to happen in a particular scenario. And some of them are really simple. I mean, one of the laws that I don't talk about too much is that populations grow exponentially if they're not getting eaten and if they have enough resources. And so some of these laws can be very simple, but they're really relevant to our daily lives in that they act all around us all the time. And one of the reasons I wrote the book is because I think they're worth sharing, worth having more people know about.
One of the laws you talk about is as sort of foundational is natural selection. Obviously, Darwin, going back to Darwin. But a lot of people would go, does that even matter to humans anymore because of medicine, because of all our scientific sort of buffering from the natural world? Are we still subject to natural selection?
Well, so humans as a species are subject to natural selection, but it acts relatively slow on us. We have long generation times, and we are evolving, so there's some evidence that there's evolution in humans in response to really poor diets, that those poor diets are actually causing us to die earlier, and the people with genes that predispose them to the consequences of poor diets are likely to have fewer children before they die. And so there is selection happening on humans. But in the book, the bigger story is that as we look at the biological world around us, selection is happening on all these other species that interact with humans. And so, I think the example that's probably in people's minds today is the evolution that's occurred via natural selection in the virus that causes COVID-19.
Yep. Yeah.
And so that virus has offered us a master class in the power of natural selection to shape the world around us. And that virus is not alone. If you look out your back door, all the species around you are evolving. If you look in your kitchen, there are bacteria evolving in your sink. Right now, as you and I talk, there are bacteria evolving relative to each other on our bodies. And so this process that Darwin thought was probably kind of slow is actually, in many cases, very quick and happening all around us in ways that directly affect our lives.
One of the great pleasures of this book is that you quote a lot of experiments of other people. And so you back up what you're talking about with experimental evidence. And there's so many interesting studies that have been done. But early on in the book, you talk about, and I'm going to mispronounce his last name, Michael Baims?
Yep.
The giant Petri dish experiment. That was freaky.
Yeah, it's an amazing experiment. It was inspired by Michael's advisor, and who had seen an advertisement for a Hollywood movie that was a giant Petri dish. I'm going to forget what the name of the movie. Maybe it was Contagion. Is that? That Petri dish inspired him to think about, well, could we actually use this experimentally? And so Baim and his advisor and other folks in the lab then set about trying to make this big giant Petri dish, which was filled with agar like a normal Petri dish, but the gimmick, the experiment, the trick in this story is that the Petri dish, when if you went from the outside in, was laced with higher and higher concentrations of antibiotics until you got to the middle, where it was kind of an atomic antibiotic concentration, something that we would hope would kill everything. And then what they did experimentally was to release bacteria on either end of the giant Petri dish that were totally susceptible to the antibiotic, so they should die. And the only way for them not to die as they spread across the agar was if they evolved resistance. And then what these scientists were able to show is that again and again in experiments, when they did this, the bacteria would fill the first column with no antibiotics, and then a few lineages would begin to spill over into the next column. Those lineages that had evolved resistance, I mean, almost in real time. And eventually, they would get all the way to the middle.
Jeez.
And this would happen consistently, depending on the antibiotic, in 11 to 13 days, if I get the number right. And so here's the sort
11
of
to 13 days.
Days. And so super quickly. And again and again, and you can watch this online. I encourage you to do so. You Google Megaplate. And it's really shocking to watch. And this is exactly the thing that happens in our bodies when we overuse antibiotics. It's what happens in pigs' bodies when we give them antibiotics to trigger growth. And it's very predictable. And so that's the scary part. But the hopeful part is because it's predictable, we can also do things to work to outsmart natural selection. Because if we remember that it's a law, we remember it's going to happen, we can step back and think, how do we account for this reality when we're planning? I think that's one of the lessons that I hope comes out again and again in the book, is that if we recognize these laws of the biological world, we can make better decisions.
One of the laws you talk about of human behavior relates to control. And we're always trying to simplify, and this is in your own words in the book, life's complexities. And that's one of our damning features.
Yeah, I mean, I think about it like a river. You know, my dad's family grew up along the Mississippi River, and the Army Corps of Engineers did all this work to straighten the river, to put levees up on either side of the river. And that's what we try to do with nature in general. Is we try to simplify it. We try to control it. We like the idea that we're really masters of nature. And the thing is about nature is that nobody told nature that was our plan. And so, you know, the river overflows the levee. It predictably does. It will continue to do so. And when we imagine that we've sealed ourselves off from nature, the same thing happens in many different forms. And I think, I mean, this is an important sentiment as we look to the future, because as we look around us, we see billionaires flinging themselves into space. And as they do, they portend, they describe, they suggest a future in which humans are bubbled off from the living world and have just brought the species with us that we need. And that kind of hubris has gotten us in trouble for at least 12,000 years, and it will continue to get us in trouble unless we recognize that we are part of the rest of this living world, and it will continue to act on us and act on our efforts at control, regardless of how powerful we think we are.
Well, this also brings up another law you talk about, the law of anthropocentrism. We really see the living world, the natural world, through the eyes of us and how it relates to us, not understanding how it really is. And one of the best examples comes later in your book when you talk about, you're at a conference where people are talking about the end of nature. And Sean Nee, I think is how you pronounce it,
yep,
came up with this evolutionary tree, which blew everybody's mind. And people don't even realize this. We are no way near the dominant species on this planet.
No, I mean, I mean, it's fascinating to me. I'm a biologist. I spent my life trying to see the living world as it is, and yet I'm still just as blinded by my, you know, monkey senses as anybody else. You know, and those monkey senses evolved. They evolved to see other monkeys, and they evolved to see fruits, and that's what we're good at. But what we've now come to understand is if you look at the tree of life, most of the branches in the tree of life are single-celled organisms. If you look at the diversity of the biological world, you know, there are thousands of mammal species. By one recent estimate, there might be a trillion of bacteria species. And so we're actually very unusable parts of the living world. In fact, all vertebrates are this, you know, just a tiny, tiny branch. And so because we have this really strong misconception about what the living world looks like, we think it looks like us. We often come to mistaken conclusions about how to manage the living world and even what's happening. And so You know, it's common now to talk about the end of nature. And there are things that are ending. Lots of the species I most love are going extinct. They're rare. Some of the forests that I think are most beautiful are threatened. But what's not threatened is nature, in as much as that all of the worst things we do to the living world favor some species. And often they're very unusual branches on the tree of life. And so what we need to understand is that what we're doing is we're disfavoring the species that we, with our senses, actually like and are likely to benefit from. And what we're favoring are these really extreme species. But it's not hardly the end of nature.
No, it's just going to be a different nature.
A different nature, a nature that's much less hospitable to us.
Those organisms that you're talking about, extremophiles, the things that they found out in the last, say, 20 years about bacteria and different other kinds of single-celled creatures, they can survive. It's like we can't come up with a habitat that they can't survive in.
No, that's right. I mean, any place that we're able to go to study them and not die, they live. And I mean, it's one of the challenges with studying them is nobody wants to go to those places.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't want to go inside like a hot geyser.
No, right. So people can go to the Galapagos, they can go to a nice temperate forest, or they can go to like the Danakil Desert in Ethiopia, which is one of the hottest places on Earth, and it's sulfurous. But in those places, you find these organisms that are tolerant of conditions that we think to be so inhospitable as to be lifeless. And really, our perception of those species has changed in the last few decades, because we used to have to always, when we go to those extreme places, we used to have to grow the organism somehow. And often they have such extreme preferences that we don't know how to replicate those preferences, so we can't grow them. But now we have kind of a CSI extremophile approach, where you can go to these places and you can find their DNA and break open their cells, and you can identify them without ever growing them. And what that has revealed to us is just that these species are all over the place. And one of the interesting things for me is that, you know, in our houses, we think we create a pleasant environment in our houses, but we actually create many really extreme conditions in our houses. And when we look to those places, we often find species that we would find in extreme environments elsewhere. And so in hot water heaters, there's a really unusual lineage of microbe that's found in hot water heaters and volcanic hot springs.
Well, you did a number of studies of life in people's homes, didn't you?
Yeah, we've studied thousands of homes, yep.
And you found like a plethora of life in the little nooks, crannies, and weird places.
Yeah, plethora is an understatement. Yeah, I think we found 80,000 kinds of bacteria, 40,000 kinds of fungi. We found more kinds of fungi in houses than there are named fungi in North America.
Oh, my God.
Thousands of species of insects and their relatives. And they're always there, you know. I mean, they're often inconspicuous. And what changes is which species you have there. And so, I mean, often I give talks about this work, and people say, well, I know you found stuff in people's houses, but my house is really clean.
Right, right.
And for me, the thing I always then remind them of is that one of the places one of my colleagues sampled is International Space Station. And the International Space Station turns out to be full of life. There are tons of fungi, tons of body bacteria. And so we're never alone. We're always in this conversation with other organisms, even if our eyes don't tell us we are. You know, we look and see nothing, but it's there.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Rob Dunn. He is the William Neal Reynolds Distinguished Professor in the Department of Applied Ecology at North Carolina State University and in the Center for Evolutionary Hologenomics at the University of Copenhagen. We're talking about his book, which is a great read. It's sobering, but it's a great read. A Natural History of the Future, What the Laws of Biology Tell Us About the Destiny of the Human Species. There's so many, every chapter we could do an entire show on, but let's talk about the laws of diversity. And especially I want to talk about the diversity stability law. And I found the studies, people like Tillman and Downing doing the big bio experiments. What have people found about the importance of diversity?
Yes, that's a great question. And so these are studies that, you know, ecologists often study sort of isolated, faraway places where they can control things and look at the rules of nature in isolation. And then much later, we tend to turn back and reflect on how those rules relate to our lives. This is one of those cases where Tillman and Downing and others worked in these old fields, so essentially human-influenced grasslands in Minnesota. And what they wanted to see is if you varied the number of species of plants in a particular field, how did that affect how that field functioned? And one of the things they were able to see is that if the more kinds of plants you had in a little patch of grass and sedges, the more stable that patch was through time. So year to year, there were fewer differences in how much living matter was there, how many species that grassland supported. So in and of itself, that was really interesting. But then they also saw in really bad years that those more diverse patches were also more buffered from the consequence of those bad years. And so there was stability engendered by having more kinds of species. And you can imagine a couple of reasons this is true, but the simplest one is that if you have more species, the odds that one of those species has the right stuff for dealing with a bad year go up. And so if you're thinking about drought, if you have 16 species, the odds that one of them is a drought-tolerant species and will survive that bad year is much higher than if you just have one. It's the same kind of way that stock investors balance their portfolios. It's the exact same concept. And so that went on to be worked on and by ecologists in sort of remote sites for a long time and proved to be more and more robust. It was conditional on some things, but it seemed to hold. But what nobody did until much later was actually trying to figure out how does this relate to our human world.
And this was going to be the next question I was going to ask you. The incredible research of Delphine Reynard.
Delphine really took this to the next level in that she stepped back and she thought about global agriculture. And so she wondered, okay, if more kinds of plants in a local old field makes the place more stable, does more kinds of plants, more kinds of crops in a country buffer that country from year-to-year variation? And what she found, long story short, and you can read more about it in the book, but the quick take-home, is that yes, countries that plant more kinds of crops were more stable year-to-year in response to the vagaries of changing climate. And so this is the only study that's been done on this amazingly at this global scale, but it seems robust. And I think the important lesson is if that's true, well, we know that in the coming years we're going to have more uncertain climates, more
that's
variable
right.
climates year to year. And so this kind of diversity is something we really need to tend to. And I think stepping back a little bit, we need not only to tend to, you know, making sure we have enough diversity at the country scale, but also locally. We also need to make sure that we have seed banks so that, you know, well, what if none of the crops work? Well, at least we have seeds for the next year.
That's right. That's right.
And we need to be prepared to buffer that risk. And I think on some level that seems really intuitive. Like, well, why is that? You know, why does somebody have to discover it? But I think the part that's not intuitive is that our dominant approach to agriculture today is actually the opposite.
Right.
It's to plant ever more of a handful of lineages, of a handful of crops at ever bigger scales. And when times are not changing, that's a great solution for a variety of reasons. But when the conditions this year and the conditions next year are bad, it really puts all your eggs in one basket. And we're very much moving towards an eggs in one basket world. And it's dangerous for us all.
This concept was further refined, and there's a concept of evenness. Can you address that?
Yeah. So ecologists have spent way too much time thinking about how to measure diversity. It's one of those things
that we
should be talking about something more fun at bars, but we talk about how to measure diversity. And so one way you measure it is just the number of kinds of crops. So just count them. You know, I have 16, you have 14. The other way to do it is the number of kinds, but also how balanced the representation is of the kinds. And so if you have just a tiny amount of 15 crops and a lot of the 16th crop, that's very uneven. If all the pie wedges are equal, it's more even. And it's that evenness that actually confers a lot of the benefits in terms of stability. Because it means that, you know, your loss from that bad year is corresponding to a smaller proportion of your crop portfolio.
And it was also found that the effects of diversity, there was an effect on the resistance of species to parasites.
That's right. And people have shown this even within a field. And so if you plant more kinds of rice in a rice field, the rice field is more resistant to the parasites and pests that might affect it. And small farmers have known this, you know, sort of in traditional knowledge context for a long time. The trick is, you know, at a small scale, if you're planting lots of kinds of crops, planting lots of varieties, it's often hard to harvest them.
Yeah.
Because they ripen at different rates, you know, and so you've got one part of your fields ready at one time and the other part's ready at another time. And people are working on solutions to that problem for particular crops, but it's not always easy. You know, it's easy to step back and say, well, in a big picture, this is what we should do. And when you get to the level of the field, things often get trickier. But we do see lots of these layers of benefits. The flip side is that there is risk. So if you're a farmer and you have one crop that grows great, then there's not much incentive for you to plant a high diversity of crops in that particular year. And so I think one of the things we have to do is to subsidize in different ways in different countries farmers for planting that diversity that's benefiting everybody. And so there's a collective benefit when the farmers are planting different things, but it's not always realized in a given year for an individual farm. And so that's when policies and governance come in to help think about this.
One of the things that I find frustrating is that there's a lot that we know, but trying to get large-scale businesses and corporations to understand what we've found out seems to be the ultimate challenge.
I think it is a challenge, but I'm also hopeful. You know, I'll say at the end of my last book, Never Home Alone, I took a cheap shot at architects. Like I wasn't finding any architects that were really engaging biodiversity. And so one of the other laws in the book is that we're dependent on many other species, our health and well-being,
yep,
our existence. And this is true for how we plan our cities, how we plan our dwellings. And so I took a pot shot at the architects saying, like, why aren't architects doing this? And to the credit of architects everywhere, architects have since reached out to really embrace this idea and say, well, how can we work together to bring biodiversity into housing plans? I'm working with an architect now who wants to figure out how to bring the benefits of biodiversity to low-income housing.
Wow.
And so I'd say that experience has really reminded me that there are a lot of people out there who want to do great things. And sometimes it's a matter of, you know, connecting people and pulling them together around bigger efforts. And so, on the one hand, things move slowly. On the one hand, there's lots in the news to be sad about. On the other hand, I think there are a lot of great people who want to do great things. And whenever they want to send me emails about great plans, I'm always happy to see them.
The book ends, the final chapter of the book is sobering because as you write, we will go extinct. That's the first law of paleontology. We're not, as a species, going to live forever.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's interesting. People are really different how they see that last chapter. I find it kind of, it doesn't make me happy, but I feel at peace with it in the sense that to think about the fact that we will go extinct reminds us that we're part of a bigger biological story in which we're one piece, and that biological story will go on. And something about that to me is actually hopeful. And some readers feel that hope. Other readers clearly see the last chapter with horror. And I left it.
Well, I looked at it just
what the split is. So go ahead, Mark, start.
I looked at it just as that's the way it is. I didn't find it horrific or comforting, but that's the way it is. We aren't. It seems our biggest problem is this anthropocentric, you know, sort of lack of humility in the face of nature. And so that last chapter to me seemed to be the thing that was the kick in the rear end of that attitude. Yeah, we're going to go extinct. That's face it. And if you want to live well and happy for the remaining time that humans have on Earth, we need to do a few things.
That's right. That's a good summary. We will go extinct. We can do some things to prolong our time on Earth.
And have that prolonged life be nice, be good, be fun.
Yep. And that requires us to respect the rest of life and respect life's rules and take them into account. And if we don't, you know, the beauty of life is that it goes on.
That's right. You have a great
story will keep unfolding.
You have a great end sentence. I'm going to read it. After we go extinct and after the last cow falls, life will be reborn from what is left. It just won't be us. It'll be bacteria. Right?
It'll be back. Well, it depends how much we destroy, but it will be reborn. And the first thing to take place in that rebirth are things with short generation time. So the bacteria will evolve before the last computer shuts off. The story will unfold.
The last computer gets a blue screen and it's all over.
It's got that spinning wheel. That's the last one.
Oh my God. My guest tonight has been Rob Dunn. He is the William Neal Reynolds Distinguished Professor in the Department of Applied Ecology at North Carolina State University and in the Center for Evolutionary Hologenomics at the University of Copenhagen. And we've been talking about his book. It's a great read. I have to say, I just kept reading it. A Natural History of the Future, What the Laws of Biology Tell Us About the Destiny of Human Species. I recommend it highly. Rob, it's been a real pleasure.
Oh, thanks so much, Mark. I really enjoyed it.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.